I'm speaking today with Kevin Jones, who is a serial entrepreneur now investing in companies that do good. As part of that, he is the co-founder and principal of Good Capital and a creator of the Social Capital Market Conference. Kevin, it's great to have you with us today. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks. It's my pleasure.
Can you tell me what Good Capital is and what led you in your background of more traditional entrepreneurial ventures to establish a fund that really supports social enterprises, for-profit and also non-profit social enterprises?
Sure. Well, you know, my basic background is I was a ministerial entrepreneur, and I'd done good things in one part of my life. I'd been involved in public schools in Mississippi during my life there, and I'd done business in a separate part of my life, merging them as much as I could, but only doing as much as the market would bear, really. And sold my last business, had a good time, and kind of was looking to start another business because that's kind of what I did. And my daughter asked me this question, what's your life about? She said, you got enough money, you've proved you can do business internationally. And it was not a question I'd thought about answering for a couple of decades. I'd thought about it when I was young and I'd been involved in things, but it really wasn't something I thought about. So I got on some nonprofit boards and discovered that the slow consensus process of nonprofit boards was not a place that I could be very effective. And I tried to do some direct service, led a malaria project in Swaziland and Mozambique. And that, again, is it takes more of a community organizer approach than it does a fast-moving serial entrepreneur approach, or at least that was my discovery. And I was at a point in my life where I didn't want to be a CEO anymore. I'd done that a lot. And so I wanted to see if I could help other young entrepreneurs do this odd thing of mixing their mission with the bottom line, with the impact. And that if they could, I was seeing a lot of social enterprises where they were real businesses and they could accelerate their social impact and really have a scalable social impact if they got the fuel, the capital, and maybe some of the other help we could provide to get them down the road faster. So my partner, Tim Froedlich, and I formed a Good Capital just to do that, expansion capital for social enterprises who are ready to grow.
And do you remember one or two examples of a social enterprise that you first noticed and were attracted to their model? Or how did you first come in contact with, in a way that it really permeated your mind, how did you first come in contact with the idea of business and social cause together?
You know, it's kind of funny. I heard about it on a panel. I heard the word social enterprise, social purpose business. And it struck me, that you would do business for a social purpose. I've done business for business. And I've done social mission things for social mission, being involved with my wife in Habitat for Humanity in Mississippi and other things like that. But so it really just sort of struck me between the eyes, and it was kind of funny. I went up to the guy afterwards who had spoken about it on the panel. I said, is this real? Are you not just making this up? This is something that's possible? And he said, yeah. And he said, as a matter of fact, the organization of nonprofits trying to do this, Social Enterprise Alliance, is meeting tomorrow in Seattle. And so, I flew up that next day to see what the Social Enterprise Alliance and what Social Enterprise was all about, and asked enough intrusive questions that by the end of dinner that next night I was on the board. So I threw myself in.
Do you think, that's really interesting, do you think that you would have been as open to that because you had been very successful at doing business for business? If you had come in contact with the idea of social enterprise earlier in your career, would you have dismissed it, or do you have a sense?
That's an interesting thing because I'm finding a lot of, boomers like myself who are at the other end of their career saying, what do we do now? And I'm talking to a lot of them who are, in their late 40s, that kind of thing, sort of, sold their business, looking to do what's next. I was around 50 when that happened, a decade ago. And, I've been talking to several of them about it, and it's kind of like the message has to hit you at the right time or something for at least people of my generation. I'm finding millennials who are, you know, 20-somethings that are all about it and never bought into the system. I sort of see I have a three-way generational lens where boomers are waking up to who they used to be, and that's people like me. And then you have Gen Xers who are kind of stuck because they have kids and they have mortgages, and they're realizing that the time they spend and get paid well for is not how they want to spend their time. You know, they're doing some version of optimizing the supply chain of Monsanto, or, you know, if you remember the first part of Fight Club where he's an actuary trying to figure out how to pay off people who are in faulty car wrecks because of faults with the cars. You know, they're doing something like that, and they feel stuck and they want to transition. And then millennials who just aren't buying in at all. They're not buying into the system. So I think, you know, the answer, I'm finding that the answer has a generational lens, that, you know, for boomers it's different. We suddenly wake up to who we used to be.
Mm-hmm. So how does good capital work? What is your model, and how are you trying to support social enterprise?
Yeah. I think our model, we are in structure a traditional venture fund. So we're the general partners, and we have people who give us their money, and it's equity, which means that it's at risk, just like it is in any venture fund. And we put that equity to work for the for-profit social enterprises to give them money to grow. Actually, we're about to complete an investment with a large nonprofit, a sort of innovative kind of operating debt, but it's really just growth capital that nobody else gives them. And they're a world-class nonprofit. We've been looking to work with a nonprofit who is ready to grow and take on a new kind of capital. And so we're doing that. I can't say who it is, but we should be able to within a couple weeks. And
be able to repay the capital? Do they have mechanisms to generate an income in their model?
Yeah, well, it's complicated. It's kind of performance based. It's like if you put equity into a for-profit business, you only get paid off if they do well. And so for the nonprofit, it's the same thing. And so we have to show, you know, our money is partly at risk, and if we don't produce what we say we can produce for them, in partnership with them, bringing in more money, bringing in different kinds of things, optimizing their operations in ways that we think we can help with, then our money is at risk. So it's structured from our side a lot like a traditional for-profit investment. And, you know, if just like in our equity in for-profits, if we don't help them hit their goals, then the capital's at risk. We lose it.
And so in addition to providing investment, you also provide counseling and guidance and
we find the right people to help them. You know, that's really what we do. And one of the things that we and folks like us are finding is that people will work for us for, you know, what I've started calling a meaning premium, which means they will work for our companies for less than they would charge, you know, a standard corporate. Let's just pick on Monsanto because they're easy. You know, they'll charge the full rate because they don't want to be there and they don't want to be doing that. And for us, they do want to be there and they want to be doing what they're doing. I mean, we had a fellow that worked for Better World on search engine optimization, how to get figure out Google search in a whole better way and the other searches. And he was working for a collection of big pharma, big pharmaceutical companies. And so he was really good. And, in fact, I met him when he was lecturing Google's own customers on how to reduce your search engine optimization costs, your SEO costs.
Mm-hmm.
But he knew that at the end of the day, if your gray aunt was sick with diabetes, you would hear more of what Ciba Geigy or Novartis or whatever other pharma he was working for wanted to tell them than you should. And so he knew that he was, you know, working against the health of people because he was making sure that the pharma's message got to them more than independent research. And he didn't like that. I mean, you know, it's not that he wants to make people less healthy and be a mouthpiece for big pharma. So he came to work for us and it's turning up around, and we you know, Better World is doing phenomenally well. We invested at $20 million, and they're at $48 million and profitable, and they've gotten rid of nearly $3 million in debt, $2.7 million in the last 6 months, I guess it is, just because they're profitable and discharging the debt. They're going to fund $1 million line of business expansion from their own capital. And we found him other gigs because we only needed him for a while to fix that. But then I found some other contracts. But for that time, he worked for us for much less than his market rate because he got a meaning premium. He got something in his life where these really great talents that he has, the abilities to really help people optimize their search engine costs, could be used for something that he would not feel ashamed to talk about. And so we do that a lot. Well, we just do that a lot.
Mm-hmm. I like the phrase meaning premium. That's good. How do you select the companies? How do you find and select the companies that you want to work with, like Better World Books? And we can use this as a lead-in to talk about them because you've done some really interesting things with them, as well as help them become much more profitable since you've been involved.
Yeah. Well, you know, we get well known and speak a lot, me and Tim, and you know, so people come to us. So we get to choose from a lot of potential companies, and they have to be. We're an expansion fund, so we have certain criteria. You have to be around a couple of years. Your model has to be proven. Have to have more than the visionary social entrepreneur, but some solid mid-career people have left their regular jobs to follow the visionary and build a real business beyond the entrepreneur. And there's some real money that is, you know, they're selling something to somebody and we can see that it's a scalable chance to grow. And then the social mission is baked in, and so if they grow, there's not much risk for, you know, there's it's kind of the opposite of mission creep, but it's that their mission could creep away while they tried to make more money doing something else. And so we like to see that, you know, at Better World, the mission reduces our costs. People give us books. They trust us to give us those books because we can show them how many people who are learning to read, 9-year-old girls in Uganda, 7-year-old kids in the barrios in Los Angeles are learning to read. So they continue to trust us, and so our costs are going down and are lower because of our mission. So we like that. We're really doing a lot with fair trade because I think people are starting to realize that they don't want to be complicit with, you know, the abuse of people in wages and farming in other parts of the world. And So we're doing a lot more in fair trade, and we're probably raising another fair trade focused fund, because there's a premium that goes back to the people who produce it. And so you can know that if you keep that certification, there's a third party certifier that says, you know, the mission is intact. And so I like that rather than having to do the metrics ourselves.
Mm-hmm. So what type of activities are you doing in fair trade now?
Mm-hmm. Well, so we've been with Adina was our first one, and they're a fair trade juice company, and they're really growing. They'll be, if they succeed, they'll be the first mass market beverage company in that is certified fair trade. And we just got another $15 million equity infusion, and with that money at the mezzanine level, the former Pepsi CEO is now on our board and an investor. And so that kind of, if you do the job, you have a path to sell the company. The Pepsi guy opens the door to Pepsi. And so you in beverages, you either sell a Pepsi, Coke, Nestle, you know, one of the big multinational beverage and food companies, you know, a General Foods perhaps or whatever. But Pepsi and Coke are they're more acquisitive in this space. So I think we've done a lot there, and we've kept fair trade. We've been the ones that have been really, you know, keeping the flag of fair trade flying in that company. And the other folks know the juice thing. The thing about fair trade that's interesting that I didn't know when I got into it is the thing called the premium. And it's not just market price is, you know, at 20 and you get 25, and that's a premium. But the premium goes back to the co-op that is growing the food, a democratically elected co-op in, you know, Guatemala, Peru, Ethiopia, Thailand, wherever. And they get to decide what to do with it. And they typically do one of three things. They either build a school or fix a school, or they build a clinic or fix a clinic, or they do some kind of water project, irrigation, or whatever. Sometimes they do production things where they build a processor that cuts the labor and they can produce more. But the neat thing about the fair trade premium is that the people in Guatemala are deciding what to do with it. It's not the white folks with money who are telling them what to do, which is typically what happens in philanthropy. It's really those folks who are deciding their future from their own efforts. And so that's really an exciting thing to be part of. It kind of flips the traditional, you know, philanthropic power dimension on its head, where, you know, the people with money and power assume they know best for what poor people should do.
Why did you get into, I just want to back up a moment, but why did you get into create your fund as an expansion fund for businesses? What was it about businesses who, as you said, already had a track record and had some capital and had people in addition to their visionary you felt would be, right, I'll let you go on.
So there are different kinds of risk you can agree to take on or not take on in a business. And expansion funding is less risky than seed funding because they have a track record and you can know that it's there. It was really, really challenging for us to tell our first would-be investors that there is a space between giving and investing that is real, that is as rigorous and as accountable and as efficient as traditional investing in traditional business, but it can be philanthropically motivated. You can do it because this is the way that you want to change the world, and in fact, this can be a more efficient and more highly effective way to change the world than purely giving. At Better World Books, we've given 7.5 million to literacy groups. We give about $7 a minute, just because we're a $100 a minute business, to literacy groups, and then we have this odd thing where they get equity inside our company.
I want to hold off on that for one moment because that's really interesting. But was it a challenge to tell your investors about the space in between investing and philanthropy because it's a new space and they believe that doing good and making money are at odds with one another?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, the main thing we run into is the dominant myth of capital is what we sort of call the two-pocket myth. I have one pocket that I just look at financial return, and I want to put as much money in that pocket as I can, and then I do philanthropy out of the other pocket, out of what's left. And we say, you know, there's this space in between that partakes of both, and we, you know, it's like trying to get somebody to move their mental furniture. It's like, you know, back home in Mississippi, it's like trying to explain to somebody what their carbon footprint is. It changes the way they think about things. And we've had people that came to us and said, you know, I could give you $7 million, but I can't invest a dollar in you because I can't think like that. One of the first investors we went to is a serious investor, but he was also a serious philanthropist and some of these new kinds of, you know, venture philanthropy. And we went to him because we thought he would get it. He was in both spaces, but he couldn't be in this neutral space. And I remember, you know, fairly vividly, he said, you know, I think your idea is wrong. I think your plan is flawed. I think you're the wrong guys. The chances for failure are high, and I don't want my name associated with you. And he left us to pick up the tab for breakfast. So we got a lot of reaction like that just because we are selling something that is not the dominant myth. If we had sold people on do just as well and do just as good, we would have sold more people. But our goal was really to change the way people think and act. So we were kind of little zealots holding our ground, but now that our companies are doing really well, people are thinking, well, geez, maybe their idea is not wrong, maybe their plan is not flawed, maybe they could be the right guys, maybe we have a good chance for success. All the things that people didn't think about us, now they think about us. And of course, entrepreneurs, I mean, you know, you jump into an entrepreneurial opportunity because it's new and because nobody's done it that way and you think you can do it better. And that's kind of what good capital was. So as an entrepreneur, I've been told, you know, similar versions of, you're the wrong guy, your plan is flawed, your chances for failure are really high. You know, I've heard that before. So, you know, that didn't, well, I can't say it didn't bother me, but I said, well, you're probably right, but we're going to do it anyway.
So what makes you good capital successful? What makes you able to now turn heads and have those people who left you to pay for breakfast say they were onto something and their strategy is taking hold here?
Well, we've picked good companies and we've helped them succeed. I mean, that's really what it all comes down to. And we've, you know, I can talk a lot about what we've done. I think our engagement is probably, from what I understand, it's a lot deeper than a lot of mission-focused investors. We get really involved in hiring and really involved in strategy and really involved in tactical implementation. And, you know, it's worked. But, you know, the other thing was I think the timing was right and there were more of these businesses around there than people knew, but people weren't ready to look at them. They weren't ready to see them. So, you know, we invested 23 months ago, and, you know, if we'd done this 6 or 7 years ago, there probably wouldn't have been as many companies around. And we, you know, and there might not have been as much talent who deeply wanted to be involved and make a difference, who wanted to help our companies.
So let's talk a little bit about Better World Books. And can you talk to us about what you call mission insurance and how you apply mission insurance in a really creative way to Better World Books?
Yeah. Well, you know, I got into this space through – I was working with as a volunteer with Social Venture Partners, which is kind of a giving circle, full circle fund kind of thing. And I was working with a particular nonprofit, Juma Ventures, that had, I think, 4 Ben & Jerry's ice cream shops that they owned. And they did these machines are still outside. I'm coming back in. And they had they sold Ben & Jerry's at the San Francisco Giants and the 49ers stadiums. And they in the shop, they could have about 40% of the workforce, you know, teenage kids, being from at-risk youth, is what they call them, you know, former gang members or whatever. And they had social workers on staff, and the kids would learn, you know, how to, a lot of them were out of school, but how to have a GED to get a high school equivalency, how to have a managed bank account through an individual deposit account. And lives were really changed by that. And but then Ben & Jerry's sold to Unilever, and the problem with the nonprofit partner shops was it was the private philanthropy, mostly of Ben Cohen. And then Unilever, looking at it rationally, said, well, if the people in the marina in San Francisco learn that 40% of the workforce in this kind of, you know, nouveau hip neighborhood are former gang members, will it make them want to buy more or less ice cream? Well, it'll make them want to buy less ice cream. And the same thing was true at their, you know, signature shop at the corner of Haight and Ashbury. And so they got rid of it. And so the mission didn't fit in with the corporate goals, and so it was struck down. And so that life-changing, it's adapted, it's grown, but it lost all of that immediately. For a while, it was a crippling blow. And so I wanted to invest in a company where if it succeeded and sold, you know, Better World's at $48 million, if it gets to $100 million or better, it has a great chance to sell to, you know, lots of people, or go public, or whatever. You know, there's a lot of exits when you're profitable and you know, $100 million. And I wanted the mission to not be stripped out the way it happened with Ben & Jerry's when it sold to Unilever, when it sold to the multinational. And so the thing we came up with was really two had multiple parts, but one of it was that we would put 5% of the founder stock set aside for our nonprofit literacy partners, Room to Read, Books for Africa, other National Council of Family Literacy here in the U.S., World Book in South and Central America. And they would vest, you know, their stock would become real and to them, just like you vest in stock options at a, you know, Valley company. They would vest on two metrics, how many books they brought in, and then how well they did on their own mission. And they have to report back to the foundations on how well they're doing on their own missions. So that reporting is already there. And then it turns out there's a big thing around social metrics. A lot of times social metrics cost more than they're worth or can even be harmful if you're measuring the wrong thing. But in literacy, you measure by doing the mission. Every teacher wants to know, how is Sally, how is Nandeli, how is Julia doing on vocabulary? How are they doing on syntax? So measurement is part of delivering it. So we do that, and so they vest. So we're setting an actual monetary price on literacy inside the company as one of our assets. And so we have this odd thing, and it's being studied by the Yale Law School because it's a real mind-bending thing, but if we grow the asset of 9-year-old Ugandan girls who learn to read, then we have higher margins. So the more efficiently we and the highest volume at which we create create literacy in the world, the more profitable we are. Because people will look at the number of Ugandan girls or the number of 7-year-olds in the barrios in Los Angeles who learn to read and know that they can trust us to give us their books at college book drives where we get the bulk of our product. You know, college book, you know, Room to Read does a book drive on a college campus or book it does. And so
you're saying if you do this mission of the company, which happens to be a social mission, well, then that funnels that the profit stems from that. And so that's how you can have higher margins.
Yeah, because we have a low cost of goods because people give us books, right? Everybody else has to pay for the books. People trust us, and they give us their textbooks, and libraries give us their books as well because they trust us of what they will, and that we will do. You know, we will pay off literacy the way we said they would. A Brooklyn Library last year got $90,000 from books that would have gone to the landfill that they got to put in unrestricted income, and then about $45,000 for Brooklyn Reads, a local literacy group. The same kind of numbers are for the Queens Library. Other big libraries are getting the same kind of thing. They would have gone to the trash. We recycle them and sell them, and they get the money. But imagine that we're being acquired, okay, and the hard-nosed accountant puts on his green eyeshade and wants to say, this do-gooder business, I can make it more efficient, I can squeeze out the cost. Well, he's going to look, and he's going to find that if you reduce the number of 9-year-old Ugandan girls who learn to read, your cost will go up. Your cost of doing business goes up if you take out the mission. Our mission, our social mission of creating people who learn to read, of enabling people to learn to read, enables us to have lower costs and higher profit margins. So it's unlikely that whoever our acquirer is will want to strip out the mission because they don't want to report to their boss, well, hey, I found a way to increase our costs and do bad things at the same time. You know, they're going to have to say, you know, we have to keep expanding the number of 9-year-old Ugandan girls or Zambian girls or, you know, young boys in the barrios of L.A. who learn to read if we want to keep our costs down. So that's mission insurance because I don't think, you know, where Ben and Jerry's, when they were bought by Unilever and they took a hard-nosed look at it, then they said, if people know about this social mission, are we going to make more money or lose more money? And they decided they would lose more money because people didn't want to know about it. It didn't enhance the brand, and it actually lowered their revenue because they got a discounted deal to the nonprofits. So they could, you know, it cost them money and it would hurt the brand. That's not what, if you have a social mission that's going to cost the company money or hurt the brand, it's not going to survive. But with us, it builds the brand and it lowers the cost. So our hope is that the and our firm belief is that the social mission will survive, because you know the social mission makes your cost of doing business go down and makes your profit margin go up.
So Kevin, what can social entrepreneurs do to attract the interest and support of socially conscious investors? Perhaps they're smaller and they're not looking for expansion funding from good capital, but what is the landscape now, and what can we tell these entrepreneurs who need capital for their social mission, who've got some business savvy, about how they can get this funding?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I mean, I think the number of companies that have 1 to 2 million in revenues that we could look at in our next fund are growing. And I'm seeing a lot happening on seed funding, which is, kind of you're just out of the blocks ready to start. First Light out of Grey Ghost is doing 4 different seed funding kinds of things, one in San Francisco that we're hosting out of the Hub, the co-working space in San Francisco and Berkeley, one in Colorado with the Unreasonable Institute, one in New Orleans with an incubator, and one in Mumbai with another group. And I'm seeing several other seed funding like things. We think we're being asked to put together just a seed fund related to the Hub, which is we're just opening the one in San Francisco in the bottom of the Chronicle building in a couple weeks. That's going to be 8,000 square feet, a lot bigger, and just do a seed fund. And, there are a lot of people who want to fund these things, and they know that seed funding is higher risk. We picked expansion capital just to prove our point, because we wanted to shake out some of the risk, not take on some of the risk. But the market is saying to us and to Grey Ghost and to a lot of folks that they're ready for seed funding. And so I think that's happening, and more of that will happen. There is a gap between seed funding and where a good capital or a renewal or a Grey Ghost would come in with their traditional funding of the $250,000 to $500,000 companies. And they're going to have to stitch that together with a little help from the seed funds, a little help from angels. It's kind of uncertain how that works, but I'm seeing it come together. So,
Sorry, go on.
Well, and I guess the big thing
more
I'm
risky.
To see,
oops.
Yeah.
Do you think it's more risky to invest in a social enterprise? Are there more people now who are looking to do that, or who are willing to do that, or because they see it as a good, having it as a wise investment choice, or is there still a lot of just discomfort around that?
I think more people are willing to take it seriously because of some funds like ours and some New Cycle and First Light, and some of the other funds are showing that it's possible and that it can make sense. But whether it's risky or not is, there is an added risk element, because if you look at it purely in financial terms, because you're not just trying to sell ice cream, you're trying to sell ice cream that also transforms lives, going back to the Juma Ventures things. And so there is a cost of that, but the thing with social enterprises is the cost of the social mission is lower if you can earn income to support the social mission than it is if you have to depend on, kind of going around and asking people to give you money, because you generate that. And so social enterprise is maturing. The biggest thing I see with young entrepreneurs and their plans is that almost all of them have in their plan how they will change the world. Too few of them have an idea of who their first 5 or 10 customers are and how they will sell them.
That's interesting. That's really helpful.
Yeah, I want to see who buys it early and why from any of these seed funds. I can see that once it gets going, once the network starts to have its effect, that you'll transform the world. But I just want to see, if we give you some money, what happens early? What happens next? We're looking for that.
That's really interesting. And that's a great point. But how can these social entrepreneurs get noticed, or what can they do to, beyond showing how they can, what their plan is to selling to 5 to 10 of their initial customers, what else can they do to attract the funding they need?
Well, they can start making some money. You know, I mean, I guess, you know, they probably won't, it won't be your day job for a while, but more people need at least some kind of proof of concept. So that, I don't want to be dismissive about that, but we want to see that the idea can work and that you're starting to do things and you have some of those initial customers. But, you know, that said, you know, with the seed funding that's coming around, you know, they're more forgiving. They're willing to look at, you know, just a concept. But a concept with some kind of track record that could make sense if you put it together. So, but, you know, what else can they do? I don't know. It's not a clear and coherent landscape yet. There's still lots of gaps and good things that should get funding, you know, don't get funding. I mean, going to conferences, meeting people, explaining to people, you know, I mean, some of these entrepreneurs that are doing some of these things are really dedicated, hardworking, innovative, and, you know, they'll come up and, you know, if I'm speaking somewhere, I run into some of them and they ask one question and they just want one bit of help, and suddenly I find out that I'm, you know, deeply engaged in an email dialogue that I probably shouldn't have been doing, you know, from a standpoint of my time or whatever, but they made it interesting. And so, you know, I think, you know, and I think a lot of social investors are the same. You know, we want to be helpful, but we have to really, we're supposed to be spending time on behalf of our companies. That's where, you know, people trusted us and gave us their money, saying that we would, you know, we would be working pretty tirelessly on behalf of those companies. So, you know, going to places, asking good questions, and understanding the landscape, I've seen be helpful for folks.
Is Good Capital doing better than you had envisioned, or how is it living up to your expectations? And in terms of, I'm going to talk solely in terms of the financial return that it's getting.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, you know, I'm kind of, you know, crazy and optimistic, and so I expected success. But Better World Books is a bigger company earlier than I thought it would be, for sure. You know, I didn't think that they'd be 2.5 times bigger, you know, just less than a couple years after we put in our money. I really thought they were a great company that would succeed, but I didn't think they would succeed that fast. You know, I also, I believe markets emerge, and then it becomes more easy for everybody to do everything once the market emerges and it starts making sense to people. And I think that's the thing that is happening more, you know, that's why we have a conference, because there is a market that is emerging, and, you know, once people understand the opportunity, they know how to play in the new market.
And there's got to be a lot of exciting parts of your job. I mean, you're part of this new type of market. You're working on these businesses and helping to make sure that their social mission exists into perpetuity. You get to prove people wrong. What's your favorite part about the work that you're doing now?
My favorite part right now is that, you know, even that guy who said, you know, your idea is wrong, your plan is flawed, you're the wrong guys, and your chances for failure are high. He likes us now, and he wants to do things with us. So, you know, it's having people that thought we were certain to fail now say, well, you know, okay, let's see what we can do together. And, you know, you don't want to, you know, belabor the point or whatever, but I guess it's not just that we were right, but that we were all right, and we were out a little earlier, and we probably are, you know, one of the things we're best at is getting attention, and so, you know, if it was going to be a massive failure of the whole market and it wasn't going to come together, more people would have pointed to us than they would have to other people, just because we were, you know, some of the best known advocates of the thing. So, you know, one is you know, I guess on a personal basis that, you know, gosh, you know, turned out we were right. And that's pretty fun.
And do you think in the terms of as this market develops, there will still be some type of distribution of traditionally funded businesses, traditionally supported funded nonprofits, and then social enterprises that are working, that are getting social venture funding and also earnings? Do you think that is there going to be a larger shift to, I guess I'm kind of asking you to project into the future given your background in a couple of these sectors?
Well, I mean, philanthropy doesn't go away. There are things that are and will remain pure market failures. You know, working on malaria in the developing world, I mean, they're the poorest folks and there is no market to be made in serving young mothers who have low birth weight kids. You know, that's so. I mean, you know, social enterprise is not the answer to everything. If that's where your question was going, I'm not sure I totally understood it, but there's gonna.
I was thinking of what would the distribution be. I can't see it everything consolidating into a social enterprise model.
I don't think so.
Up a really good point about some things the market can't serve.
I
think there'll be a growth of social enterprises, but still the existence of purely for-profit and purely non-profit.
Yeah, and that's one of the things we're finding at this year's SOCAP is that so many people are understanding, you know, that non-profit and for-profit really are having to work together and see what they can do together that they couldn't do separately. Jacqueline Novogratz of Acumen is keying off, essentially doing the keynote. We have the short keynote kinds of things for SOCAP this coming year in November, November 4, 5, 6. And, you know, her point, October 4, 5, 6. Yeah, October 4, 5, 6. Somebody just reminded me in the background. Her point is that, you know, this is catalytic investment, and, you know, this is investment to make a difference. And so it can't just, because, you know, Better World Books is going to be a market rate investment, which is great, but they all not all of them should be. You know, that's one of the reasons we're doing a nonprofit out of our portfolio, that, you know, you're doing this to make a difference. And so you don't want to just, you know, make it be market rate when it shouldn't be market rate. This is investing to make a difference. And just because you get, you know, it was important. I think it's important that Better World come in and is a will return capital just like a venture funded deal at market rate. But it's not the only thing that should happen.
For more interviews about cause capitalism, visit causecapitalism.com.